previously on Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug.
Yeah, no, I got a little frustrated last week. You know, I'd been talking to the Nox Archaeus guys on and off for like 2 or 3 years about, hey, you should put a really good quality pulse width modulation sound effect in the boot up screen for Nox Archaeus, and I can tell you how to do it. I told one programmer in detail exactly how to do it, but A, he didn't seem to be getting everything I said. B, he wanted to do some other stuff and experiment. I'm like, you know, that might not work. You should probably just do literally exactly what I said first, get it working well, and then try and do those improvements that you think are possible and that might be possible, you know. But then he left the project before he did that. And then the guy I was talking to, it's like, well, I don't know sound too well. I'm not that good at 65. I'm like, maybe I could find a few hours and just recode for you what I did, but I never got around to it. And then they found this guy who did this brilliant pulse width modulation sound and video using some extra hardware, like, you know, 512K of extra RAM. But he did this brilliant demo at the Kansas Apple Fest. I'm like, yes, if you go with that guy, he will get you as good audio quality as I did. He's doing it the same way. You know, I read his notes. And then they picked a bad drum sound to put in. And I'm like, no, you should have done voice, you know. And now they've got a bad sound effect on the boot up, which they worked really hard on. And like, no, redo it. He's like, oh, we're about to go into final testing. I take a day or two here. I'll like record a word. I'll say it 2 different ways. I emailed it to him. He's probably going to ignore it, but I tried.
And now, the conclusion. So, Mark, good to have you back on the show. It's been a hot minute since we've had a chance to have you on to talk about the project.
Yeah, thanks. Definitely glad to be back. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Mark Lemmert, also known as Nox Fuffred Dragon, and I'm the lead developer of Nox Archaeus, a Ultima-inspired 8-bit RPG for the Apple II and modern Mac and Windows computers. And we're actually just about a couple of months from releasing the game here, which is really, really, really exciting, having done a Kickstarter a year ago and, well, been working on the project for 5 years. So it's really getting to an exciting moment here, finally.
Yes, finally. It does seem like a while. And for those of you who do want to check out our previous conversation with Mark, it's episode 120. We had him on for an extended interview about Nox Archaeus, and the crowdfunding was either just about to happen or was like we timed it so that it would happen like right during the crowdfunding, I think, is how that worked out.
Exactly. It was, I think we probably recorded it just before and then released it while it was, the crowdfunding was happening, if I recall.
Yep. So, anyways, Dr. Cat told us an interesting story back in episode 140 about some work that he was doing. And subsequent to that, after you had a chance to check out the episode, thank you for listening, by the way.
Absolutely.
You followed up with me and said that, you know, since then you'd made some progress on the issue. So why don't we start there? Why don't we put a bit of a conclusion on to the story that Dr. Cat laid down a little while back?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And it was just very interesting. You know, my ears were ringing as listening, you know, to that episode, as it was capturing a very specific moment in time in the sequence of what was going on, which was involved in interesting itself. And so as a I'll start at the end and then go back to the beginning and spend most of the time on the middle, so to speak, here, picking up where Dr. Cat left off. But just want to say, sure, it all worked out in the end. And I am prepared to play over the microphone here a really awesome sound.
Well, let's do it.
But first,
I love making chip tunes.
Only for those of you who can stay awake through my story get to hear the sound.
Okay, well then.
but yeah, it all works out in the end. But So just kind of introducing the whole topic here. After an introduction from Caliph Dragon, I first talked to Dr. Kat a couple years ago about the idea of incorporating a 5-bit pulse width modulation sound in the splash screen of Noxor Chaos. And, you know, he had been saying to Caliph Dragon and then to me when he got us together, hey, you know, you should do this because it'd be the first Apple II game to do it if you do it. And I thought, well, that got my attention because the mission of the Noxor Chaos project is to explore what might have happened if RPG games had continued to be developed on the Apple II past the end of the 1980s. And so we've very proud to say pulled off a number of firsts in the process of doing that. And you know, to add one on the audio side, I thought, well, that would be just really awesome. So I had some exciting conversations with Dr. Kat about that a couple of years ago. And I guess actually before going any further, just some quick background, because I'll be throwing around this term 5-bit pulse width modulation a lot. For those not familiar with it, it's basically it's a high enough quality that human speech playback is pretty much as clear as it would be on a modern computer, which should be impossible on an 8-bit system. And for contrast, if anyone remembers the game Castle Wolfenstein on the Apple II, it was the first game that had human voice ever. And it was really hard to make out the words that were being said. You could kind of tell it was supposed to be human voice, but it was really tough to actually understand them. That was one bit pulse width modulated sound. And so we're talking about 5-bit to get it to the point that human speech is clear and understandable, really pretty much to the point of what it would be on a modern computer. And Dr. Kat in the late 80s proved that it was possible to do 5-bit pulse width modulation with one notable trade-off. And the trade-off is that to play a 5-bit PMW sound, it takes up pretty much all the memory in an 8-bit computer to play like two or three words, which is why Kat was suggesting to do it in the game introduction screen before the game is actually loaded into memory, as he briefly mentioned in the last episode. So anyway, here's the story of the evolution of this sound over the last couple of years. After that initial conversation, I would say the project got off to a slow start and then it tapered off. Dr. Kat was very generous with his time in explaining how he created a 5-bit PMW sound back in the 1980s, that was published in Soft Disk magazine, and, the difficulty in moving the project forward was in my finding somebody with the right skill set to do the coding for the driver and then actually construct the sound itself. I wrote the Noxor Chaos game engine, and I certainly know my way around 6502 assembly language, but I know very little about sound. And the programmers who had contributed to the project to add music capability weren't familiar with pulse width modulation, had limited time available when all this came up. So that became a real challenge. As Dr. Kat mentioned, we eventually did find somebody with the right skills and the time to take a crack at it. His name is Chris Kennaway. And for various reasons, we decided to do a drum sound. Oh, and actually, want to clarify, when you say we finally did find somebody with the right skills to take a crack at it, that was like 6 months ago, as opposed to we first started talking about this 2 or 3 years ago. So it was really... A whole lot of nothing was happening for years on this, and then finally the stars line up. Right person has some time. Let's do it. About 6 months ago, and obviously the project's getting pretty late stage at that point. But I think we just got enough time to maybe get this in here. And so for various reasons, we decided to do a drum sound. And as Dr. Kat pointed out in the last episode, the drum sound really didn't demonstrate the full capability of 5-bit pulse width modulation. But when the drum sound was done, it was early May of this year. And we were scheduled to start final testing of the entire game by the end of May. And at this point, from the perspective of the PMW programmer, he had turned in the final deliverable. And my teammate, Peter Ferry, had already done the integration of the PMW code that Chris Canaway wrote into the splash screen code in the main branch. So at that point, in chatting with Dr. Cat and kind of, you know, realizing, you know, he was saying that yeah, this really could be much better. as nice as it was, could be much better. At that point, I had no idea if Chris or Peter would be available to take another crack at it before we started final testing. And so I told Dr. Cat that I wasn't optimistic that we would be able to do it. It would be really threading a needle at that point to get something like that done. And that's the point where the recording of the last episode of Spam, 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 Humbug was recorded, roughly, I believe.
You know, that probably was our last recording, actually. I haven't done a recording session in a while.
Yeah, I looked at the date of it because I'm trying to piece the timeline together because I was listening to it late. You know, it had been in my queue for a while. I was listening to it in, like, late June. And I'm thinking, like, hey, all this worked out. When was this recorded? You know, I see it was sometime, you know, in early May. And I'm thinking, okay, yeah, that lines up just about right with, you know, when this conversation was at about that point, you know. So, yep. So now, you know, picking up from now that we've caught up to where things were at with when you're chatting with Cat last episode. So basically, from there, well, under promise and over deliver is a principle that I practice. So after setting expectations that it wasn't likely to happen, I then set out to make my very best attempt to make it happen. That's just how I
operate. You do. As you do.
That's how I roll. And you know, there were, as you can imagine, there were a bunch of things involved, you know, such as investigating the disk space requirements to have a speech sound in addition to a drum sound rather than just one or the other. And I thought that was important for reasons I'll touch on. And to deal with the disk space issues, it was almost bumping up to the point where, okay, there wasn't going to be enough space, and that was going to force a whole complex set of decisions and trade-offs. But well, I talked to my teammate, Peter Ferry, who happens to be a compression master, to see if he could compress the PMW data down enough to be able to fit both the drum and the speech sound on the boot disk for the game, which is 180 kilobyte with a K, 5 1/4 inch floppy disk. He's like, yeah, we should be able to do that. So with that box, you know, at least shaded in, if not checked, I then pitched the idea to my teammate, Chris Torrance, who came up with the drum sound idea. And I pitched him on the console, well, what if we did both? And well, there were some reasons we didn't do speech the first time, so I needed to build consensus around, you know, this new plan of, like, you know, getting speech back into the mix. Well, if we did both, if it was the lead up, if it was the right tone, you know, there were, you know, this with creative people, you know, there's all these considerations. And Chris was also Chris Torrance. There's two Chris's involved here. And Chris Torrance was also going to be instrumental in converting the speech into a format that the PMW programmer could use. So, right. You know, lots of hands in the pie here. So then with all this preliminary work, you know, then, okay, so then I go back to Peter and then also loop in Chris Kenaway, the PMW programmer, and pitch them on the idea of, what if we did this? Could we do this? Would you be interested in doing this? Do you have time to do this? to do this adjunct to the project. And really all of this is to illustrate the sheer number of moving parts involved in turning the ship in a different direction at this point in the project. And basically I made the pitch and I anxiously waited, not knowing, you know, if people's schedules would line up before the end of May. You know, of course, everybody wants to do it, but is it going to be practical to do it amidst, you know, life, the universe, and everything else? And when managing a volunteer project, you really have no idea what's going to happen. Fortunately, as with Oxford Chaos as a whole, about 90% of it is all within my wheelhouse, and I only have to worry about my own timelines and life, the universe, and everything to plan around. But that other 10%, and that other 10% makes a huge difference in the awesomeness of the end result, in my opinion. It then gets complicated with many other people involved. And like I said, just have no idea what's going to happen sometimes. But as it turned out, in the last week of May, it all got done. Just before final testing was ready to start, it all got done. And I shared it with Dr. Kat, and he was delighted. I believe he said something like, "You just made my day." And I think that was the most excited that I've ever heard Dr. Kat over anything. I was thrilled, you know, to hear him saying that, being the authority that he is on gaming and programming in general, and on pulse width modulation in particular. I knew that we had done something great when
you
I done
did
say
good,
that.
Yeah.
So that made my day, probably my week, you know, to hear that. And so it all worked out. And when the game boots up, the deep voice of Caliph Dragon booms out the words, "Nox Arcaeus," which is then followed by the 5-bit PMW drum beats and Mockingboard music threaded into the sequence, and the game introduction takes off. So that that PMW speech is slated to be part of the presentation that we're going to be doing for Kansas Fest in July. For those of you not familiar with Kansas Fest, it's an Apple II convention held in Kansas City, Missouri, every year for like the last 30 years. It's been going on since the 80s. The rest of the world moved on from Apple IIs, but we did not.
That's going ahead even in the face of the pandemic, eh?
Well, it is going ahead in a modified virtual version. It is going to be a virtual convention this year, still held at the same time in July, and so we're going to figure out how to do a Zoom session with myself and two teammates. It's going to be Chris Torrance and Caliph Dragon doing the presentation, and we'll jump on Zoom and figure that out. And certainly not won't be as great as doing it in person. But the cool thing about it being virtual is so many more people are able to attend and would be able to do it in person, and that's really cool too. So, but as promised, a sneak peek here for anybody listening who's going to be attending the virtual Kansas Fest. This will be a sneak peek on just the audio part of it. I'm going to go boot up my Apple II and play this sound for you guys. Bear with me a moment as I head over to the other side of the room. All right, can you still hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Yeah.
All right, awesome. Here we go. Actually, it might take about 20 seconds.
No worries.
Getting old tech to work is part of the retro experience, so.
Yeah, if it works the first time, you didn't do it right.
Exactly.
Hey, Elgriff.
Hello.
You are just in time. You are about to hear what 5-bit pulse-width modulated audio sounds like coming from an Apple II. Okay? I don't know if you ever played like the original Castle Wolfenstein on the Apple II, but how terrible the speech was in that, ostensibly human speech.
I'm not sure I played it on that particular platform, but I think I did play it on the C64. Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, Mark is just teeing up right now the demo of 5-bit pulse width modulated speech that is going to feature in the demo or in the intro of Nox Arcaeus.
Oh dear.
You know, I have heard my experience with Apple II voice is the very tinny Ghostbusters at the beginning of the 1984 Ghostbusters game.
Oh, good Lord. That brings me back.
Nox Archaeus.
That's an Apple II.
Sounds great.
All that fuss for just a couple of words, but like I said, it fills up pretty much the entire memory on the computer to do that. one of the reasons why nobody did it.
I have been in TeamSpeak or Skype calls with less audio fidelity than that.
Yeah, and that's an Apple II. I mean, that's a computer that's older than, well, at least me. We're about my age, but...
Youngin.
Yeah, I know. I'm often the baby in the room these days, but that's incredible. That's genuinely incredible to hear an Apple II generate that kind of sound.
Yeah, I really was shocked, and it was a little bit of in the process of doing this, a little bit of a thing as far as like knowing what to expect, and Kat helped out with that a bit as well, because I was sort of conditioned to, in a way, expect that. It wasn't going to be as good as it was actually capable of being. And he sent me an elaborate email at one point basically saying, no, really, what you hear in the .wav file, from the audio recording of the speech, you should be hearing that coming out of the Apple II. I'm like, really?
Wow.
And so we, kept working at it until the speech got to that level. Which most of the work was done, just getting the drum beats. Most of the work was done getting to that point. And then it was a matter of fine tuning, but still, it was certainly an experience from there.
So for those of you just tuning in now, sorry, Drax, you go.
I was remembering a chat I had with John Romero. And he mentioned that when he programmed for the Apple II, I think it was, or that the only function that the Apple II actually had was to make the sound of a loud click, but that someone, a very clever programmer, managed to actually make the Apple II produce different sounds and even make a game with music, and that's one of the things from what he drew inspiration for Water.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's fundamentally spot on. The speaker, the Apple II speaker, it literally looks like something you buy at a Radio Shack and inside the case, and it functionally has one voice, and functionally when you're sending a signal to through machine language to the interface, to the speaker, where the programming code meets the hardware, fundamentally all you can do is you can either turn the speaker on or you can turn it off, which I think was what John Romero's point was on. That is as designed, it basically just makes a sound. That's all it does. Or it doesn't make a sound when you have it off. And it was not designed to do complex things by any stretch. And as programmers started fiddling around to see, well, what could they do, they gradually kind of got it, faking it to do some stuff a bit more than just a very static sound. And then by the late 80s, you got Dr. Cat coming in and then it's like, well, what if we did 5-bit pulse width modulation on this thing and get it really humming? somehow this one, one sound, you know, based on how rapidly you're turning, you're on and off and all that stuff, suddenly it starts to, you know, sound like other things until the, well, somebody's saying Nox Archaeist. So
yeah.
It's just astounding to me how, it's even capable of doing it.
It's an amazing feat. But I guess everyone needs to know a little of the background of how it is programmed and how it actually works to appreciate what was done there.
Well, just the sheer, it's difficult, I think, for those of us who grew up using the Apple II, it's instantly impressive to hear that because we grew up, you know, familiar with, the Apple II could beep at us. Or, like, there were some scratchy sound effects in that fishing game or, you know, Oregon Trail, right? Or these, pick just about any game that, you know, is famous from the Apple II era. Like, yep. You know, those of us who grew up with it were familiar with those. And we know how limited they were in comparison to what games can obviously include today. And just, there's so much context that you almost have to bake into to explain to a modern audience why this is as incredible as it is. Because nowadays, when you have, you know, when apparently it's not a big deal for your game download to be 100 gigabytes, you know, of course you can have incredibly high quality sound assets. And you're not, you know, and you know, these days when it's not unusual for video cards to have 4 gigabytes or even 8 gigabytes of RAM on board, let alone the 16 to 32 that you might have on the main board of your gaming PC. The idea of a memory limit being this almost unassailably hard wall, like the speed of light that you cannot cross no matter what. It's such an alien concept to the modern computer user, to the modern gamer. You almost have to kind of put that context in place just to help people understand that, you know, hearing those words, Nox Archaeist, coming from a computer of the Apple II, you know, coming from any system of the Apple II's generation, because the 6502 is used in a lot of different systems. It's insane. It's incredible.
No kidding.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate hearing how much you appreciate it, and those are exactly, I mean, you know, the reasons for my standpoint too, growing up with the Apple II, and you know, hearing the guards in Castle Wolfenstein, they're supposed to be saying Octung, but it always sounded like Roscoe to me, and it was probably because I watched too much Dukes of Hazzard at the time or something, but you just couldn't make out the words, you know, your imagination filled in the rest of the unclarity of the audio, you know.
Roscoe, you idiot!
Exactly, right?
Exactly, or like you said, the squeaks and clicks in Oregon Trail, and like, you know, that was just, you know, we knew that's, you know, the way it was. And that was great at the time, you know, we didn't know anything else. And then to realize all these years later that there was more, that there was actually more that the system was capable of that was never tapped, or at least never tapped in a production game. As Kat said, you know, he did it, you know, and it ended up on Soft Disk Magazine. And I think Greg Malone owes him a cheeseburger and, you know, some other stuff not actually ending up in a game. And like I said before, that's so central to what, you know, I and my teammates set out to do with Nox Archaeist, was basically let's pick up where game development in 8-bit RPGs and the Apple II left off. You know, there was some more of the machine in theory that wasn't tapped, you know, that just got left aside as everything went over to the IBM PC and Mac. And we thought, well, you know, let's see how much of the machine was left that we could exploit to make a better game engine. And, you know, with nonetheless yet the same Apple II look and feel and everything else. And, you know, it was really exciting to see that come to be in a number of, you know, different ways with Nox Archaeus, such as, you know, we've got a full screen map view instead of the smaller viewport. And with the full screen map view, that led to, okay, well, we're going to have pop-up windows for things like character roster and inventory and, you know, things like that. And to find it on the sound, well, that something like this was possible. It was sitting there dormant in the machine, possible, able to be done. And then, you know, we had the opportunity, thanks to Dr. Katt, Chris Kenaway, Peter Ferry, and Chris Torrance, the opportunity to pull that out of the machine and put it in the game. I'm just thrilled.
No, and again, like, it's one of those things that's, you know, if you don't have the context for it, you know, you're kind of like, well, what's the big deal? But if you do have the context for it, it's like, that's just, yeah, it's jaw dropping, right? don't want to sound too okay boomer in saying all of this. You know, there was a time, right, where there were extremely hard memory limits, you know, even into the 16-bit era, right? And, you know, you're trying to extrapolate where 8-bit game dev would have gone past when 16-bit systems kind of came to the fore. But, like, you know, even in DOS, right, there was a hard memory limit. And, you know, Origin came up with some very clever and innovative ways to...
The Voodoo Memory Manager.
Right? You know,
it was like the 640K was the thing, if I remember, in DOS. And it was like, well, you know, there was, you know, you had more memory on the computer, but it was the first 640K that, you know, was really the most useful. And then and the rest just got complicated and the memory managers started to come in. And so to your point, it was still, there was just a lot of horsing around with memory going on.
Well,
even
don't
in the 16-bit era, yeah.
Don't you know, though, that 640K of RAM is all a computer user will ever need?
Yeah, it should be enough for anybody, right?
Bill Gates noticed that.
Well, and you know what, at the time, it was probably true. But
now we have onboard caches larger than that.
Yeah. Yeah, 1 meg, 2 meg caches. But, you know, like, that's kind of where this becomes even almost, like, doubly impressive, because, you know, And not to knock modern game developers, because, you know, especially when you're looking at, you know, games built on 3D engines that are getting into that 60, 80, 100 gigabyte. And a lot of that, granted, is going to be in the art assets, right? The audio, the textures, the models, etc. There is a ton of sophistication in 3D game engines. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to knock it. But there's something very specifically and acutely challenging about working within the constraint of, you know, 640K, or in the case of the Apple II, way, way less than even that. And having to, you know, like, literally, like, every byte of memory you agonize over the use of. I remember talking with Dan Schmidt, and he was talking about Ultima Underworld, and one of the ghouls, and I think it's iSnack, but I'm not sure. All the ghouls had really wacky names in Ultima Underworld. But there's one ghoul who has a particularly, like, kind of gross name, and you can tease him about it. But, of course, in Ultima Underworld, you can pick your own name. So you see the edge case, right? Mm-hmm. If you tease the ghoul, but you have the same name, the ghoul will call you out. If you type in the same name as the ghoul, which, again, I think is iSnack, but don't quote me on that. And you also have that name, he will call you out on that. He'd be like, but it's your name too. And I remember how Dan Schmidt phrased it, though, because he phrased it very specifically in the context of, yeah, we had to allocate a couple K of memory just to capture that a possibility, right? And that's kind of a thing from people who did programming in that era, is that, you know, like, every kilobyte of memory they use is a battle, right?
Yeah, it comes down to, you know, doing things like, all right, I need to fix this bug, or maybe it's not a bug, but, you know, like, a hole in the storyline, so I gotta put some text in here to deal with this. And okay, well, so gonna add that in. What are you going to take out? Because there's no more memory left in this cloud. So it comes down to literally like doing things like shortening the names of mobs in things, you know, to come up with a few extra bytes to fund, you know, whatever the, you know, important, you know, late stage change needs to be. So, you know, that's the state that things have been at with Noxer Chaos for quite a while, you know, development wise, but it was a different exercise here with the 5-bit pulse width modulation, because we were doing it in the introduction screen, where definitely there's still memory limitations. We still have the same, you know, 128K memory limit there that we do anywhere else, but we don't have the game in memory, so we can basically do like a tech demo and use up all the memory on a couple words of sound.
Yeah. Well, it's awesome. Like, I mean, I didn't know what I was expecting to hear, but I was not expecting to hear something with quite that level of clarity. So that's a feather in your cap for sure.
Thank you. Glad that it did not disappoint, and hope that others playing the game will appreciate it as well. And like you said, it takes a context to appreciate the significance of it. And I suspect that many players of Noxer Chaos will have that kind of background, you know, have used the Apple II in the past, or at least 8-bit systems in the past. And, you know, I suspect, I won't be surprised, actually, if there are some people that wonder, you know, that are playing it in an emulator, that wonder, you know, did we, you know, hack the emulator somehow and get it to fake it, you know, tapping into the, you know, going on the other side of the wall to the modern computer. I am prepared at the appropriate time to put out a YouTube video where it shows the real Apple II hardware making that sound to allay any doubts.
Nice. Oh, that's awesome. Well, I mean, I'm pretty much blown away. I don't know, opening it up to the room, because yeah, I'm kind of speechless right now.
Well, he's got a 8-bit solution if you need speech.
Yeah, well, yeah, he does, doesn't he? It just takes all the memory, so
so just make sure the game's not doing much else when it's talking at you.
Yeah. Well, that's a good way to hide it, though. Put it in the introductory sequence, right? Because then you know, you're not actually chewing up the memory space that the game needs.
So how did you resist the urge to, if not to put in your actual title screen just when you were playing with this new functionality, do you have somewhere a clip of someone saying, "Avatar!
Put it on the table."
Know that my face is most Muppet-like.
I would say that there's a lot of temptations that I didn't really have to confront resisting, because this was such a stretch goal, such a pie in the sky, I felt like I was pushing a rock up a hill for years, that I didn't have the luxury of, you know, thinking about what do I really want to do? Oh, I'd love to do this, I'd love to do that. You know, to me, it was a miracle that anything got done at all.
Sure.
So, just given the challenges, you know, the sheer technical challenge combined then with all the project management logistics, you know, described before. So for those reasons, where I might have otherwise had to, you know, be to face those kinds of temptations, I think that was, I just got distracted out of it.
Fair enough. Well, so Nox is basically just about ready for primetime then.
It's very close. I'm estimating, you know, a couple of months. It's final testing started on June 1st, and what's happening is basically I'm playing the game through start to finish myself for the first time, and I've been doing that for a month, and I am level 6 out of 10, and I've been, you know, tweaking and tuning and fixing bugs as I go, and it's been going slow, but it's been going well. on, you know, the game's been running, you know, pretty stably, pretty stable. And the systems are holding up well in terms of the balance of the economy and the combat stats and things like that. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, like landmines that I could have envisioned and, well, did envision and, you know, worried about for years that have proved to not be an issue. So it's really going well in that respect, if perhaps a bit slowly. But basically, once I'm done with that playthrough, then I'm going to turn it over to my other teammates and then also to a tester group drawn from the community. Got a couple dozen folks that really eager to put it through its paces. And that's the plan. And when, you know, we get it to a point where it is sufficiently stable and polished, then we'll go into production mode on the physical box sets and duplicating the floppy disks and, you know, all of that stuff. And yeah, so like I said, I think a couple of months and we'll be rolling.
Awesome. Well, wow. Yeah, I don't know what else to say. Thank you for coming on and showing that one off. And that's a really awesome coda too to the story that Dr. Cat was telling. Because yeah, like you could kind of tell during the episode that, you know, he was not entirely at peace with where right. that had gone.
Yeah, it was definitely a not at peace moment in the entire sequence of things, and it was probably within a day or two because he was talking about having sent me a sound. So that's what really benchmarked it for me, because I remember the sound that he sent me, and so yeah, that had to have been a couple of days from the point where I basically set low expectations and with the hope that I would end up under promising and over delivering. I could tell understandably that it was when it was looking like it may well not happen in terms of the speech component and it just being the drums, I could tell that was disappointing for him, understandably, at that point, having, you know, waited kind of 30 years to see this happen.
Yeah.
After his pioneering effort and then over talking over the last few years for to get this far and then not, you know, kind of go that final distance. You can understand that. So yeah, not a piece, I think, would be a kind of a good way to describe where it was at the moment when the microphone turned on for the last episode. So I'm really glad to have had the opportunity to jump back on the show here and just tell the rest of the story and then share, you know, the cool sound and chat about it with you guys. So thanks.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Well, unless anybody else has any other questions, I think we might call this one a little bit early, which will give me time to prepare dinner for my wife. But if you have questions, now is the time.
Questions? Not mm-hmm. so much. I just have to express my just being entirely flabbergasted that I didn't know an Apple II could do these things. I grew up with an Apple II in my elementary school classroom, as well as in the gifted room. And mm-hmm. most of what I saw was edutainment stuff, like Mavis Beacon, Sticky Bear, Microzine, Oregon Trail. You know, trying to get my family to die over and over from dysentery because I thought it was the funniest thing when I was a little kid.
Yes.
I remember very, 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 you know, primitive one-channel beepy sound. Nothing as clear and as bright as that sounded. I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, my first experience with a role-playing game was a 16-color EGA, the Gold Box stuff. I actually went back to the early Ultimas after first playing 7 in college. And, well, that and the NES Ultimas. But we don't talk about how those were viewed in the 90s.
Well, yeah. What? I'm sure relations between PC gamers and console gamers have only improved since then.
Right.
Only. There's been no back. There's been no back walking on that one at all.
No, not at all. Oh my goodness.
I never understood how the first RPGs were coming out in the consoles and things. It was like, I can never really just comprehend, like, how can you play an RPG on a console? You don't have a keyboard, you know, in an RPG, you do all this different stuff. And how can you possibly distill that down to a couple of buttons? By the time that you do, it's not going to be an RPG anymore. It's going to be something else, you know?
It's not an RPG unless I need a full keyboard plus, you know,
that's right,
18 keys to play it.
With an extended number pad. Just
yeah.
To be fair, a lot of your console RPGs were kind of based originally on early PC dungeon crawler RPGs like Wizardry and, let's be completely frank, Ultima 3.
Well, yeah, Ultima 3 is at the root of, like, the entire JRPG evolutionary branch.
Exactly. And they started focusing less and less on the deep story and more on the mechanics and the dungeon crawling and the loot and the fighting.
Well, at least for a time, right? And then it kind of almost went the other way.
Quite.
You know, now it's like Final Fantasy is basically just like a story to be experienced with some mechanics layered over top.
Oh, I in my current run through of Final Fantasy, I'm specifically cheating my way past most of the mechanics because they got in the way of the story.
I hear some rumblings from Draxnath, though. You object there.
Actually, Dragon Quest 1 is more based on the first two Ultimas. It's a single character, and it's a one-on-one battle against the enemy.
It's a fair point.
And you even have to rescue a princess at one point.
Now, if you want to... good JRPG that really draws a lot of base from the Ultima 1 and 2 mechanics, especially the dungeon crawling, you only have to look as far as Phantasy Star on the Master System.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
This is true.
That one has actually smooth scrolling 3D dungeons.
Ultima 3 was probably an easier one to port to the console than like Ultima 4 or 5, I'm just thinking, because in Ultima 3 with talk and you get a one line response, which 90% of the time is good.
Yeah, there's
never comprehend, like on a console, it's like, what are they, a picture of a keyboard and you sit there and, you know, controller your way around each letter to type in name, job, and all that stuff. I just can't fathom how that could be.
No, this isn't the Netflix search box on my television. Like,
or to work around that.
With all the innovation we've been talking about tonight, someone could come up with that.
You know, just to make the game that much more hellacious, right?
Ultima 3 for your Netflix interface.
Yeah, let's make Ultima 3 the new Doom. Find ways to run it on everything, right?
On everything, right, yeah.
Oh my goodness. Well, that's awesome. Oh my goodness. Well, cool.
Something I wanted to ask, the Apple II, actually, the floppy drives only read one side of the disk. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So you have to swap disk?
Correct. Swap
the other side.
Swap disks and swap sides of the disk. So we're literally like flipping the disk some circumstances. Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, these are just alien concepts these days.
Yeah. Actually, the Famicom, which uses the same CPU as the Apple, also had disk flipping with the disk system.
And you love this. Think about that aspect or that curiosity of disk drives on an Apple II. So, you know, we would do in the modern era. Use double-sided, double-density 5 1/4-inch disks, which also work on other 5 1/4-inch platforms where you didn't have to flip the disk around. On the Apple II, the way the drive is set up, you flip the disk. But if you want to use the second side, you need to get out a paper punch and punch a hole in the side of the disk in order for it to be able to write to it.
Yeah, actually, I had a special puncher, which made the the square hull for the floppy disk.
Yeah, that's
I forgot all about that.
That's the right way to do it. And I've got a square puncher now. I was thinking back to how I did it as a kid. You know, not owning such fancy tools, it was like literally pull out the paper punch because we had a paper punch in the house. You know.
Yeah.
Just use that. You know.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I remember that, and I remember later getting the square puncher. That was over 30 years ago.
Man. Like, there's just, you can't even contextualize that for a modern audience, right? It's like, what's this whole idea of non-writable media?
It's like,
it's
like trying to explain someone about rewinding an audio cassette, and they try to understand it by what they know, which is the CD, and they think, what?
It's like going back a track. Yeah.
Fire.
But you have to turn the CD backwards to go back a track.
Yeah. Entire catchphrases are just lost. Be kind. Please rewind.
It's like, well, why wouldn't you want to be able to write to your media? Well, so you don't accidentally copy over it with, you know, something else with using your copy program. What's a copy program? What do you need that for?
Yeah.
the layers of information that's necessary for it to make any sense.
Look at everything we've made obsolete.
Yeah.
And the sectors and the tracks.
Well, at least sectors and tracks still kind of exist a little bit. Like, there's still an analog in modern OSs for that. But yeah, so much of this other
you
stuff
don't
like
specify,
just
you don't specify directly.
No, you're not directly accessing
that
them.
From you. The operating system has a layer over that, and actually, it can write a single file, all scattered around the disk if necessary.
Yes.
Exactly. The there's all those layers of abstraction in you know, between you and those constructs, even though they still exist. Whereas in the Apple II era, when writing a large scale game, you had to go right down to the metal, and like our file access system for Nox Archaeus is actually at the lowest level, having to deal with issues like moving the drive arm on the floppy disk drive and the timing issues that go along with it, because you got the platter spinning and you got to get the drive arm to the right place at the right time, and you're getting garbage data coming off the drive head until it gets to the right spot, and you've got to throw that out. You're counting clock cycles, you know, for like how long, dealing with all that stuff, which is to just pull data off of the disk versus you know, you just run a copy command, and yeah, somewhere down there it's dealing with tracks and sectors, but it's insanely difficult but also insanely satisfying when it actually works and produces something.
It takes me back to the story of Mel the programmer. Ever read that story?
I have, you have to refresh me on the details of it, but I swear that I think I saw that passed around most recently a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it's a sort of a, something called it a legend, and not everyone believed it was true, but then someone actually found the guy and some books for the computer mentioned on the story, which have him credited as a very important programmer and a person who wrote manuals on how to program that computer. But what he did was, the way the story tells it sounds really amazing, because he would not use delays. He would actually rely on the hardware's timings for creating delays, and on for the memory, there was a memory drum from where they would read data, and he used the travel time of the reading head for creating delays. So if he called data, then the head will travel to read that data, and he used that time as delays. And he structured the program and wrote it all around the cylinder or the drum, or all around the drum, the memory drum, to adjust it to what he needed and the delays he required for the program.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, you got a source of a predictably amount of time that's going to be the same every time. You know, that's old. Mel was old school. Well, that's cool. Someone tracked him down.
Yeah, that's
I got the text here. I can post a link. Okay.
Yeah, I'll make a note to include that in the show notes. That's great.
Here it is. Actually, the first time I found that story, it was just I was a bit of a tired of how I was studying at the university, and I did a lot of hardcore programming back then, and all the other students were just too shallow, too high level, and they would not do anything impressive or cool, save for one or two of them, which were very geeky, and we used to hang around together. And I was a bit tired of the mediocre level of the others and their attitude towards programming. And I Googled this exact phrase, "when programmers were real men." And that was the first hit I got from Google, the story of Mel.
Nice. Yeah, you know, that makes me think of more modernly trained programmers and not being aware of kind of some of the origins and of things and why things are the way they are. I think it was a couple of years ago, a friend of mine who's a programmer that when he would have been in school for programming, but sometime in the last, say 15 years, not 30 years ago, 10 or 15 years is probably when he had his training. And he says to me one day, he's like, you know, whoever came up with the stupid idea or made the stupid decision that arrays should start with an index of zero instead of one, you know, should just be taken out and shot or something.
There's 10 kinds of people in the world. Those who understand binary and those that don't.
Right. Well, yeah. And I thought, okay, just to phrase it in the way as though that there was like a decision that was made about it. Like this was actually a design decision of you know, we're just going to make it start with zero instead of one. Just yeah. Because, you know,
just to mess with people.
Just to mess with people. You know? Why not?
Well, even, you know,
there are actually several languages which start with one.
There are some, yeah.
Well, there are, and I think that's part of what was creating the confusion on his part. Is it's like, well, yeah, in some cases he could do it comfortably starting with one, and in some cases he couldn't, and you know, missing there without the background, missing that the languages that are letting you do it with one are wasting memory somewhere along the line, and they're abstracting that from you in the program. Of course, the modern computers have memory to waste, so it's not a problem. But you know, back in the early days, started. You know, there was no way we were not going to use zero. You know,
well, you know, it even to the point of like, you know, we talk about all of these challenges. I was listening to one of the security podcasts I listened to, down the security rabbit hole, and the host, Raph, was talking with one of his buddies who had a very storied career working in all different kinds of fields, a lot of them programming related. And they got onto this somewhat extended riff about, you know, C, the C programming language, and how, you know, you talk about like modern programmers, even something like C is almost going to be arcane to them these, you know, the idea that you have to carefully manage memory allocation in C or you will crash your program. Like, that's a very alien concept in a lot of modern languages, right?
As a very Bush League low-level programmer, as in I taught myself QBasic with the manual on an old IBM PS2. Now, I went from that thinking I was hot stuff to going to college to learn C++. I thought that C itself was horribly wasteful with memory and in space. Because programs I would have to include this, that, and the other for in college to do like a simple thing I could do in under, and get in like 30, 40K, I could do in less than 1K of code in BASIC.
You know, my grandpa had similar objections. He C and the C-based languages were not his thing, and he was not a fan of them. And actually, even more than that, like I remember working one summer on a SCADA system for one of the gas companies around here, and the lead programmer had basically, like the main tech guy at the plant had basically licensed the source code for several key components of the control system, which are written in C. These had to run on PDP 1184s. Okay. So, you know, like these are the computers that like gave us Tron graphics. Kind of gives you an idea of about how old they were. And like he like licensed the source code for several key components of the control system, which are written in C, and he rewrote them in, shoot, I can't remember what other languages he used, but the whole idea was to cut out memory overhead. C does have a memory overhead that some other languages don't have. The trade-off, of course, is that C also has the ability to be powerful in ways that some other languages cannot. So that's, I mean, I don't know. To my grandpa's great heartbreak, I was a fairly early convert to C. I actually really love programming in C, even though managing memory is a royal pain in the ass. But I just, I find there's a certain elegance to coding in C that I really enjoy. But it is not for the faint of heart. And C++ is for the outright suicidal.
That's what I was trying to learn stepping up from QBasic.
Yeah, no, just don't.
You know, I bypassed normal C and went straight to C++ because that's what my guidance counselor suggested.
I hope you never went back to that guidance counselor.
Well, I kind of dropped out of that college later because, well, I discovered MUDs. Discovered Ultima 7. Yeah, everybody here old enough to remember what a MUD is, raise your hand.
Yeah.
Hand raise.
Yo.
Yep. I tease my kids about that all the time.
Multi-user dungeon, I think it stood for. But yeah, I remember telnetting around, and I didn't spend a lot of time playing MUDs, but I was involved in the early internet service provider industry, and I remember, you know, we had MUDs hosted on our servers until they started to bog them down, and eventually we had to kind of not allow those anymore.
Yeah. And then the people who played the MUDs screw up and made a request.
Actually, Furcadia came first.
And so did UO and Meridian 59.
You're absolutely correct, but the reason I bring up EQ specifically is if you look at the mechanics behind EQ and how several things work, it was specifically the same, you know, mechanics for blocking and shield bashing and the way skills leveled up as old school Deku MUDs had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, EQ was Raph Koster very much a Deku MUD.
Yeah, I seem to recall Raph Koster talking about that in one of his many, many writings.
Yeah, I actually listened to that in person. We were driving just from San Diego to Ensenada, we were in the same car, and then there was a university teacher driving. I was also teaching at university, and we invited Raf for a conference, and he was talking about that during the trip from San Diego to Ensenada, about a 2-hour trip.
Nice. Yeah, he tells him he's got well, I mean, come on, the guy's had a crazy career. He's got tons of stories. But which book was I reading of his? It wasn't The Theory of Fun. It was the one more recently. The title eludes me. It's a great book, though. It's just chock full of that kind of stuff. Well, anyways, I should probably wrap it up here because I need to make my wife a bit of a snack when she gets home. Because I'm married to a frontliner.
No problem. Yeah, I should probably get going here as well. But it's nice chatting with all of you.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you again. That was genuinely enjoyable.
You're welcome. Glad you enjoyed it.
If you want to join the Ultimate Dragons, you can do so at udic.org, whereat you can choose your very own dragon name. You can also find the Ultimate Dragons on Facebook. We have a Facebook group there. And you can follow at Ultimate Dragons on Twitter or join them on Discord. And if you're feeling really old school, you can even fire up a Telnet client and check out the Wearmount. Hit up the show notes for links to all of these. If you want to participate more directly in the podcast, you can send us an email. Or if you're feeling a little bit braver, leave us a voice message in one of three places: the podcast website, our Facebook page, or on anchor.fm. And you're also welcome to join us on our Discord server to chat with us, to lurk, or even contribute to podcast recordings when they happen. And again, links in the show notes. If you'd like to support Spam 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 Humbug, you can do so at patreon.com/ultimacodex, where for as little as a dollar a month, you can get access to episodes the day before they go live to the general public. You'll also get access to behind-the-scenes audio when we have some to share, and possibly other interesting content. But we also welcome your moral support. You can like the Ultima series on Facebook, follow at Ultima Codex on Twitter, or leave the podcast a review on iTunes. And you're also welcome to share our episodes with your friends and social media circles. Spam 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 Humbug is a production of the Ultima Codex. You can find show notes online at spamspamspamhumbug.com. Thank you for listening, and until next time, be virtuous.